This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm.
Today's show is brought to you by Yo Radio, the first music and radio platform with stations curated and managed by artists and influencers from across the globe. From Drake Bell to Megadeth's David Ellefson to UFC star Uriah Hall, just to name a few. Welcome to Yo Radio. Yo Radio delivers the best listener experience and is completely free. From hip-hop to rock to blues to EDM, Yo Radio has the music you want at your fingertips. Download the app now in the App Store for Apple devices and in the Google Play Store for Android. Or just go to YoRadio.com. That's YoRadio.com.
This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
All right, welcome back to the second half of Baseball Outside the Box with our interview with Brent Strom, World Series champion pitching coach with the Houston Astros, and we are very happy that he was able to do both sides of the show. I know he's been very busy, but he's very available, and a special thank you to Brent. Brent, I want to get going on the second half and basically just start off with a little question about a lot of our coaches around the world. I'm sure they run into this. You know, they get a pitcher for the first time or several pitchers. What's your recommendation on just what do you do when you get a pitcher for the first time? You've never seen them. Where do you start? You know, and how do you make some adjustments?
Well, first of all, I make no adjustments. So in terms of, I think, for an example, the first time I laid eyes on Dallas Keuchel, I knew nothing about him. Our general manager mentioned, said I just needed to take a look at this left-hander that really hadn't established himself in the major leagues. And so I went down and watched him throw batting practice. The first thing I noticed was the rhythm and the tempo of the delivery and the repeatability. And basically what I've learned throughout my years as a pitching coach, especially an older pitching coach, is sometimes the less you say, the better. Sometimes we break up bullpen sessions by interjecting every third pitch if a pitch goes high or they bounce a curveball or something like that. So my suggestion for the young coaches is to have a game plan early, indicate what the young man wants to get out of the workout, what you see as the most important aspect. If you want to go into the mechanical aspects of it, I strongly suggest you videotape the bullpen session, and any interjections need to be held at a minimum so that they don't have this start and stop. It's a lot easier for them to to feel rather than think in terms of, if I bounce a curveball, what did that feel like? What adjustment do I have to make? Basically, you're attempting in over time to let them become their own best pitching coach, and you can step aside and just be some eyes and ears to facilitate that. So that would be my strongest recommendation.
You know, and I really love what you talk when you talk about the feel, you know, how, you know, because that's so important. Now, are there some protocols that you use eventually, what happens if a young coach is struggling and let's say for a period of time, the player's throwing high a lot and they can't figure out why he's doing that. The body's not adjusting yet. There are certain protocols that follow why somebody does throw high or why they throw inside a lot.
Well, a lot of it has to do with the timing and rhythm. You know, if you really have to match up the arms and the legs so that they're timed together. I may have mentioned this in part one. Mm-hmm. Watch a young person do a jumping jack, for example, and notice how the arms and the legs are working in sequence, whether it's fast or whether it's slow or medium fast. And what you try and do is allow the arms and the legs to go into extension, and then they go into contraction. So there's a kind of an opposite effect here where you have internal rotation of the upper half. I think I mentioned this, and external rotation of the lower half. And then the lower half closes up, the upper half opens up, and you're trying to see this timing and flow that's going on with this body action. Of course, posture becomes a major key. What posture they are able to maintain as they go, if there's not a big deviation in posture. And then again, at the landing, you're hoping that it's a nice firm landing that they can rotate around a kind of a firm, isometrically contracted front hip, whether if there's a left-handed pitcher, it'd be his right hip, right-handed pitcher, it'd be his left hip, and then allow rotation to take place. You know, one of the biggest things we run into is linear pitching, and really rotation is power, and they need to understand that when you do rotate correctly, you're actually getting closer to home plate than if you try and keep your head right on line. So these are a few of the things that you might want to look at. And the other thing you can do if they're throwing high is basically work externally. Rather than talking to the pitcher about where his body parts are, you possibly can, you know, have the catcher set up low, or let's say the guy's pitching outside a lot of arm side misses. We'll have the catcher set to the inside part of the plate, or even exaggerate it the other way and see him make the adjustment and see if you can then work your way back. So external cues are probably more valuable than the internal cues of telling a pitcher, don't do this and don't do that. Let the ball flight, the spin of the ball and the location of the ball tell you what the body's doing.
You know, very interesting. You mentioned it a few times, the head. I'd like for you to a little bit expand on that, because a lot of coaches do teach, you know, take the head directly to home plate. Explain how that works. Certain guys, they don't take their head that way.
Well, the head is not the center of your body. You know, that's located down by the belly button, and depending on your posture, that center of gravity could be, let's say you're a very high overhand pitcher, like a Mussina, let's say, then the center of gravity is probably behind you. Mm-hmm. Let's say you're an upright, you're straight up guy like Garrett Cole. The center of gravity is kind of in the middle of your body. And if you're a bent over guy like a side armor or something like that, then the center of gravity is if I was a right-handed pitcher, it would be toward the third base part of the body, be outside the body. So maintaining that center of gravity for a long period of time, going toward home plate and then going into rotation is really key. What happens mostly when the guy misses high to the arm side is an early peel off, an early rotation. So there's a thing we call drive line. We try and keep our drive line going forward, mm-hmm. driving the ball in a straight line as long as we can. But then rotation needs to take place. So you'll never hear me talk to a pitcher about finishing in a good fielding position. That's something that is an individual. Maddox had great fielding position. He was kind of a straight on guy, but you'd see the little bunny hop at the end, and that would dissipate the energy going through the body. You'd see a Koufax, for example, when he would throw, you'd see the head would almost kind of jiggle or wiggle. And that's basically the energy rolling up the spine and disseminating the energy throughout the torso. You see another person maybe fall off to the first base side, but what you have to do is run the camera backwards, see where he is at stride foot contact, see if he's in line, see if the belly button is facing home plate or as close to as possible, and then allow the body to decelerate by rotating off that line. And actually, when you do that, the hand actually gets closer to home plate than if you stayed right in line.
Yeah, you know what? You answered my next question, because a lot of times, you know, the eyes don't really see everything you think you're looking at, because many times I remember Pedro Martinez, you know, falling to the side and sometimes spinning. And I'm always wondering, you know, is he going towards home? But like you said, at foot strike, where is he? So that's well said, and really appreciate clearing that up. Now, mm-hmm. we've got a lot of advantages, and I say we, you especially have a lot of advantages, but every day, you know, I'm looking on the internet. There's so much technology that we can use to help our advancement of the movement patterns or hitting. What kind of technology do you use to help you become a better pitching coach and help your pitchers?
Well, we do have the best of all worlds here, obviously at the major league level, because the stakes are so high. Certain things, we obviously use TrackMan a great deal. We have Rapsodo. I think one of the best devices we have is our camera collection, where we can take video up to 1,000 frames a second, which really hones in on the critical point of release. And so we can slow the camera down to see where the hand is in relation to the baseball at the point of release and what's happening at that time. So you may see a guy who the ball is cutting all the time, let's say, or the ball's peeling off, or his curveball, let's say, is not what it should be. At 1,000 frames a second, as opposed to 30 frames a second with the standard camera, mm-hmm. you can see, for example, if a guy is throwing a curveball, if he stays with the curveball all the way through to release, what happens to a lot of guys is as they start to throw the curveball, just at the critical moment when the final arc is taking place, they start to pronate their hand, and therefore they get what we call rifle spin, and they don't have the overspin that you see with the guys that have the great curveballs or the great sliders. And so that becomes an important thing. So the high speed camera is important. The TrackMan, the Rapsodo, these, all of these tools we utilize, plus some other ones that I'm not at liberty to talk to right now, that will try and give me and Doug White, my bullpen coach, either a yes or no on what our eyes are telling us. You made the statement that our eyes deceive us. They sure do. Mm-hmm. And so I either need validation or I need somebody to tell me that I'm completely off my rocker as to what I'm thought, you know, my teaching that it will go to the player. Because the last thing I want to do is give them misinformation. Sure. There's enough misinformation out there already, and players have a tendency to also give misinformation to each other at times. And not because they don't want to help, it's but that the help is not helpful, so to speak. And we just need to be careful about what we say and what we teach.
Yeah, and there's a big truth. There's a lot of information out there. And like you said, a lot of it's misleading. My head blows up sometimes just being on the internet, looking at things and trying to research. You know, so I know it's not easy. But we got to filter through a lot of that stuff. In 1999, I was with Jay Ward in Thunder Bay Independent Ball. And to me, Jay was one of the best coaches, managers that I've ever been around. And one of the things, we didn't have the technology, but we used a lot of charts. And, you know, we had team meetings about hitters. Give us a little background, what you can, and how you guys prepare for, you know, facing a team, the hitters, how you might pitch to them, why you pitch to them in certain situations.
Well, without getting into our what we do, if, for example, we're in Dallas right now. We play the Rangers tonight. I'll obviously go in early the first day of a series and review notes. We've played them, I think, a number about maybe eight, about 9 or 10 times already this year. So we're familiar with this team. But, you know, some of them may have changed since the last time we saw them. Mm-hmm. I know that Chu, for example, has a 42 game on base streak, and he's swinging the bat well. We'll notice who the hot hitters are. And what we'll try and do is just kind of look at where they like the ball, whether they're a free swinging type team or what we call a zone control team. Certain hitters take a lot of pitches. Other hitters are free swingers. If they chase, if they don't, if they're high ball, low ball, that kind of thing. And so we try and match up the data and then what we try and do is take the pitcher's strengths, whatever is in his toolbox, and try and, when we have our meetings, indicate to that particular pitcher that this might be a good way to attack this guy. This might be, you know, might be an advantage, things like that.
Sure. But now, when you have your team meetings, obviously, or, you know, scouting reports come in, you're looking at all this information. Are you looking at, like, if a hitter has a weakness, are you exploiting that weakness? Are you pitching to the pitcher's strengths? I know it's a general question, but give us an idea how our coaches can kind of go, you know, work with that.
Well, you know, that's a very good question, because ultimately you want to probably lean toward the pitcher's strengths, what he's capable of doing. What you don't want to do is ask him to do something that he's uncomfortable. Usually hitters will have a few places that you might be able to exploit, and therefore you try and match up whatever the pitcher does best. I'm obviously not going to ask a Verlander, for example, to throw, you know, nothing but change-ups to a particular hitter, because that's not one of his strengths. Mm-hmm. His fastball is, his elevated fastball is, things like that. So let's say a guy's a high ball hitter. What you can do is utilize the fact that he is a high ball hitter to throw the fastball higher than high. And so basically you are giving the hitter exactly what he wants, but it's not exactly what he wants. Or let's say a guy's a low ball hitter. You can throw pitches lower than low. So there's an enticement factor here that takes place. And then what you do, so there's really, it's just a matter, it comes down to execution more so than game planning. If you can execute, then usually you're in pretty good shape, you know. So it's all the best laid plans are fine until it's kind of like the fog of war. You go in with a great game plan, and until that first punch is thrown or the first bullet is shot, then all of a sudden it becomes you have to adapt on the fly and make adjustments to what you see. And the catchers are good that we have are good at that. They can kind of see if guys are moving up in the box, moving back in the box, moving further away from the plate, things like that, to try and mask a weakness that they may have, and then we have to go and make an adjustment.
For our young coaches out there, are there ways that you know, they don't get a chance to see a lot of hitters and they may not know the hitter. Are there certain things that maybe hitters do, you know, get close to the plate, away from the plate? I don't know. Certain things that maybe they give away what their weaknesses might be?
Well, you see guys move up in the dish, up in the plate sometimes. They may, you know, generally speaking, there's nothing that's definitive, but they may feel that that they're trying to catch the pitcher may have a really good breaking ball, and they're trying to catch the breaking ball before it has depth. A guy that is deep in the box doesn't want to get beat with the heater. A guy that maybe has an inside-out swing, you know, gets off the plate, let's say, things like that. So you kind of have to look at the swing path, and really it's not where they stand. It's the path that they take with their foot when they attack the ball. You have divers, you have people that open up prematurely, things like that. So a lot of times you'll see hitters hit with the count. They'll cheat to a certain spot. These major league hitters are very good. The count gets 2-0. They'll take that fastball on the outer half because they were looking for the fastball in the inner half to do damage. So it's kind of a general type of thing. And I would suggest watching batting practice to see guys swing past. So you have flat bat guys, you have guys that have extreme elevated type of bat paths where they're trying to lift everything. So obviously the lifters, the high fastball might play. The flat bat guys, you got to stay down in the zone. They're high ball hitters. And there's some left-handers, for example. We just left Tampa Bay, and they have a very good young hitter named Bowers. He's a flat bat left-handed hitter, and he's doing quite well. So you have to, when you see him for a little while, then you start to make your adjustments.
You know, great point about watching BP. I remember Jay Ward, we used to take our pitchers and always watch the team when they came in and took BP the first day and analyze all the hitters. You know, you hear a lot about effective velocity, calling pitches. How much do you, you know, talk to your pitchers about effective velocity, you know, pitching in and out, up and down, across and all that?
Well, I'm a big proponent of Perry Husband, who devised this segment in 2003, I believe. And I've known Perry for a long time. I go to him for advice at times, and he's the godfather of effective velocity. You see it now on the internet. You see a lot of people talking about it. I think the tunneling idea becomes important, where you have pitches staying on the same line as you go, so that possibly you can, for example, the high inside fastball followed by the curveball comes out of the hand in the same line and can create a difficult illusion for the hitter. So there are different, I urge anybody that's listening, if they really want to get into this, at least partially, because it's difficult to understand at first, is to pick up Perry Husband's effective velocity books or his videos, because they're excellent. So absolutely. I think that would be easier way to explain it to your group.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What a fantastic person too. I know we've had him on our show. I believe it was 10 shows ago, and it was just unbelievable. And he needed like 10 hours, you know, to talk about everything that he knows. But, you know, it's great to see that, you know, and this was going to be my next question, because of young pitchers, especially young kids coming up, whether they're 13, 14, 15, is there a certain protocol that you recommend, you know, where they start off throwing fastballs and then maybe go to a second pitch and a third pitch? What would that be, especially when you're talking about, when we talk about tunneling and being consistent with your release point?
Well, I don't have any children, but if I had a young pitcher that I was working with, I would work on forcing fastballs right down the middle of the plate, followed by changeups. That would be my protocol right there. I think it's a difficult combination for young hitters to hit. Mm-hmm. Once they can, the middle of the plate should be your friend. If you throw a fastball right down the middle of the plate and you get a foul ball, there's a lot of options for you. You have the forcing fastball down the middle, followed by a two-seamer away, by a cutter in, a slider down, a curveball down, a changeup. You have elevated fastballs. You have all kinds of ways to go based on that one pitch that's down the middle. The fastball changeup combination would be the first two things I would teach a young pitcher. I think those are the things that will get you the furthest in this game. Mm-hmm. And then adding the breaking ball obviously is an important thing. But I cannot overemphasize the value of the changeup. It's a lot of these camps that people go to, everything, the sexy little gal at the dance and everything is that everybody wants to throw 95, 96, which I think is a false narrative for most people. And they're just not going to do it. They're just not going to do it. So why not find out, take what you can do to get what you can. I often ask this question, would you rather have a guy throwing 89 with a plus changeup or a guy throwing 93 with no changeup whatsoever? And I'll take the I'll take the lower velocity plus the changeup any day of the week. It just is such an advantage to be able, because hitters have difficult time seeing speeds. They see angles very well. So curveballs sometimes and sliders, they can see angles, but that changeup becomes a very difficult situation for hitters. And I just would highly recommend playing with that pitch as much as possible at an early age, so that when they get the changeup sign from the catcher, the wiggle of the fingers, they become super empowered to realize this is a power pitch. This is basically a slow fastball. So I'm, again, giving the hitter what they want, but it's really not what you want. And I give you that great illusion. So it's highly recommend it. And it's something that we continue to emphasize. It's not an easy sell, because everybody wants to throw hard. And the hitters want you to throw hard too. They don't want to have to deal with speeds very much.
Right. And you're seeing right now at the major leagues, I know you look at MLB Network, they discussed that a great deal about there's a high strikeout ratio going on. They're higher than most in Major League Baseball. And they're discussing how hitters are going to catch up to that. That's probably another reason why a lot of people want to throw hard.
Well, you know, the thing is, you know, with the advent now that, you know, guys are lifting the ball, home run becomes prevalent in the high strikeout. I think what's happened, quite frankly, is that prior to this explosion that we've had, most pitchers worked inside and outside. And so you worked up more of a horizontal type of game. And so you had balls being hit all over the field. You know, it'd be interesting to see a Tony Oliva or Rod Carew or Wade Boggs right now. There is no shift for those guys. Mm-hmm. But the way the present day hitters are hitting more, and now with us pitchers throwing more of a vertical type of attack, I think that leads to more home runs because more pitches are in the middle of the plate, but it also leads to more strikeouts because of the bat path that a lot of these hitters take. So the high fastball and the low curve and the bouncing curveball become very good weapons. So you're seeing more of a vertical attack, and the fact that hitters are strikeouts don't seem to be a concern as much anymore. Mm-hmm. And the shift has obviously been a big play in this thing. It's been a complete transition from the days of the guys like the Tony Gwynns. I mean, I read a stat the other day, quite amazing, that the three great pitchers for the Braves, John Smoltz, Glavine, and Maddox, they faced Tony Gwynn 270 plate appearances. Tony Gwynn struck out three times.
Wow.
270 plate appearances. And he hit 394 off that threesome. So that shows you, and so until hitters at the minor league level start to understand that the opposite field can be your friend, I think we're going to continue to see the prevalence of the way the game is going today.
Well, well said. And I also love what you said about, you know, young pitchers, how they should start off, what should they work on. Thanks for saying that. I think a lot of people appreciate that around the world as we're educating coaches and players and parents as much as we can to help grow the game at the grassroots level. Brent, we got about 10 more minutes, and I just wanted to, one thing I wanted to ask, but I think this is a general question that maybe a lot of people are kind of curious about. You know, when a pitching coach like yourself goes to the mound, and I know there's a lot of scenarios, but can you give our audience an idea of some of the things that you may tell your pitchers? Maybe you don't tell your pitchers. Maybe you're just talking about something else just to loosen them up. But can you give them an idea of what goes on the mound sometimes?
Well, I'm usually very honest with them. I don't like to make a lot of trips. A trip can actually be an honest thing. I could walk out to the mound and you're on the mound, Peter, and I say, Peter, I'm only out here to give Joe time to get loose out there. And I think he appreciates that. So I said, I'm just going to stand out here till the umpire comes and tells me to leave. And then I might leave him an idea, say, listen, your breaking ball really will play against this guy. And then I'll leave. There's never a mechanical discussion. I'll never say, get your glove up, get your arm up, any of that nonsense. It's basically a positive message as much as possible. And a reminder, let's say if the ball's hit back to you, where are you going to go with the ball? How do we want to start this hitter off? I'll consult with the catcher. And so we come to a consensus here. And then I go back to the dugout and I pray, Pete, that quite frankly, I actually say a little prayer, hoping that my information will not lead to a grand slam home run, which has happened before. And that is not very much fun. You have this sick feeling in your mind. You tell a guy, lead this guy off with the breaking ball. He doesn't swing at breaking balls. And of course, then you throw one and he launches it into the Crawford boxes and you give up a grand slam home run. It's a sick feeling. So there's prayer comes into it for me as a pitching coach oftentimes.
Yeah, and sometimes we forget that that breaking ball he threw was probably, you know, he hung it and it wasn't in the spot, that he was intending to throw it. But we don't always think about that part because we're looking at the grand slam and saying, wow, why did he?
Well, for example, the numbers may indicate, let's say that this guy swings at a first pitch breaking ball 6% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So 94% of the time he takes the pitch. So you see this number in front of you. You take this information to the mound and say, listen, first pitch breaking ball, you'll get your 0-0 strike, and then you go to work. And then you throw it, and he swings. And he hits a double in the gap. You hope you don't lose credibility because you really were playing the odds here. You just got beat. You know what I mean? It's the dealer hit the 21 with six cards. You had 20, and you lose that particular one. You can't, you hope it doesn't happen too often, but those things will happen over the course of a long season.
Absolutely, and I'm glad you brought that up because around the world we talk to coaches all the time, and you know, we express to them that, you know, you've got to make your decision, stay with your decision. You made it on a calculation that, you know, especially a lot of times as a hitter, you see swung late three times, you move your defense over. Okay, now all of a sudden it happens, hit the ball down the right field line. That doesn't mean you were wrong. So we stress that a lot to our coaches. I think fear comes in that decision sometimes. Sometimes they won't make a decision after that happens because now they're.
I think everybody becomes result oriented, mm-hmm. and I strongly urge you to become process oriented.
Yeah.
You know, work your process, and you'll come out ahead most of the time if your process is correct. And my suggestion would be to recheck your process, recheck your thought process, what you're doing. But we become so result oriented that, for example, a guy could hit a line drive right at the third baseman at over 100 miles an hour, and you're patting each other on the back for a job well done, and then a guy could break a bat, bloop one down the first baseline, and you get beat as it hits the chalk line, and you're beating yourself up. I mean, this is a very non-caring game sometimes, and it can be very brutal to you. And so you have to understand the process and stay the course, so to speak.
Right. Two more questions. The next one I wanted to ask you, in the off season, just some general recommendations to young pitchers, what they should be doing in the off season when they're not pitching, or not playing. What are some of the big league guys doing? What do you recommend?
Well, depending on the number of innings pitched and their health, you know, I'm not a big believer in taking the entire winter off. I think that work can be done. I would strongly suggest the players get an assessment by a qualified person to find out where their deficiencies are. They may be very strong in one area, weak in another part of the body. Perhaps the back of the shoulder is not as strong as the front of the shoulder, things like that. So get a true assessment and then go to work on that plan. It could be a flexibility program you might need. Mobility, it could be a strength program, it could be a stamina program, whatever the course may be, but get on a program. It doesn't need to be anything huge where you're going to bulk up or anything like that. Just my suggestion is just don't jump into the weight room and start pounding weights and all of that stuff without getting a true assessment as to your overall body composition. It may be you need to possibly lose some weight to be able to take some stress off your legs or whatever, or you may need to gain strength or something. That would be a huge thing for me. And I would continue to throw. I would continue to, like we talked about, the changeup. The wintertime is a great time to fill the air full of changeups. Every time you play catch, get your changeup grip and throw the ball so that it becomes second nature to you, or your curveball or your spin or whatever you're trying to create. If you need to create backspin on your fastball, try and find a qualified, certified person that might have a Rapsodo device that can tell you that your spin is 12:30 or 12 o'clock, or is it 1:30, whatever, and it'll tell you the axis of rotation of your ball. And perhaps you might want to if you have access to a high speed video, see where your hand is at release and perhaps make an adjustment in your delivery. But use the work backwards, so to speak. Let the ball flight tell you what you're doing right or wrong. I just got done hitting some golf balls and realize how inept I am at times, where I can hit one really good and one poorly, and then I start to get in my head too much about what I'm doing. And I really should let the flight of the ball tell me that felt good, that did not feel good. And hopefully we'll kind of reinforce that. So it's a difficult process. I'm fully aware that teaching movement patterns is not easy. And so it's a complicated task. I just wish everybody well in their pursuit to try and help the best they can.
Well said, you know, and I can tell you, I've been in the game 35 years and I'm still struggling with it. So, but I keep trying to get better. What about weightlifting? Your guys weightlift during the season, like after a game, before a game? Is there any protocols used there?
Yeah, it's an individual basis. There's some guys that they do a lot of do the weight work. We have the individual periods. We have periodization going on where certain times during the year they do a certain amount of work. Others do more. Others do less. There's some guys that don't lift at all, and they're basically in a maintenance program throughout the season. So it's an individual thing and what the player might need. We take body fat type stuff. We take strength type stuff, all of that. But, so it's kind of an individual program that we have. We're still tweaking that. I think that's the next frontier for most of baseball is to understand what is needed in that regard. A lot of testing going on mm-hmm. with regards to best type of exercises to use, which ones to stay away from, things like that. I'm not an expert in that. I leave that to the experts in the strength field.
Yeah, absolutely. And we recommend our coaches, they go see the experts in that area to help them analyze their players and put a program together. Brent, the last question, and really want to thank you for being on the show. What makes Brent Strom as good as you are, pitchers or in general, being a great teacher, that would help other coaches become, better at what they do?
Well, I kind of go by the mantra that I don't know what I don't know. And I'm still reading. I'm reading books all the time. I'm currently reading a book by Franz Bosch, B-O-S-C-H, out of Europe on strength training and coordination to see if there's a connection there. So I think I'm actually fearful of giving wrong information. So I'm, and I've done it in the past, and sometimes it works out by accident. Other times I hate to guess if I've hurt any of the young people I've worked with my entire career. It was never done by intent, but just keep having an open mindset to new ideas and kind of develop a philosophy that you're going to continue to learn and try and tweak. Don't fall back into the habit of being afraid to say you were wrong. I think that's huge. I think if you make a mistake, you use trial and error and learn from it. I think that'd probably be the best advice I can give to coaches. I'm 69 years old and I still don't, have the answers. I'm still searching. So
fantastic advice. Love it. And I got to thank you so much for being on the show. Thanks also for being with the International Sports Group and helping us around the world and educating coaches. I want to wish you a successful season this year. As long as you're not, as long as you're not too successful against the Cubs, I wish you the best.
Okay, we'll see. Okay, bud.
All right.
Thanks. Okay.
That's Brent Strom.
I'll see you. Bye bye.
World Series champion pitching coach, Houston Astros, one of the best in the business. I want to thank him for being on the show. Thanks to Brian Kroc, our producer with the Lineup Media Group. Thank you for all of you listening to Baseball Outside the Box. Don't forget to go to @BaseballOut on our Twitter. Lots of great information. Also our Facebook page, Baseball Outside the Box. I know you enjoyed the show because I took a ton of notes. So again, we'll see you soon. Have a great coaching day and see you on the next show.
This has been Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Listen online at baseballoutsidethebox.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm. This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.